Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, December 21st, the first day of winter, the winter solstice. I figured there ought to be a party or something today. I'm sure many of you are celebrating in some way, but got to put something on the docket for measuring this day and looking for the light, which returns. It's all things political. Oh, I have one more announcement. A second hour of our program, we're doing the best books of 2009, and we've been asking you to go to our Facebook. So if you go to the Facebook, it's Kathleen, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Some of you have already written down books because we're going to be talking about books the second hour of our program. Always a favorite gift for me to receive and to give. So we'll be giving you some great suggestions, hour number two. All right, let's get rolling. All things political. We have to start with health care reform because the Senate's been really busy over the weekend and had a vote at 1 o'clock in the morning. I don't know why it was 1 in the morning, but that will be my first question. Our guest is Professor Joseph Kunkel, professor and chair of political science, law enforcement department at Minnesota State University. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. Or you could send an email, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Joseph Kunkel, hello. Thanks so much for being with us. Happy winter solstice, first day of winter.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Why did the Senate vote at 1 in the morning? I never understood that.
Well, it's rather bizarre. I think they're trying to get it done. They've got to get it done. I think the Democrats feel that if this goes into the new year, then it could drag on and on and on. They thought they were going to get it done in August, and now it's dragged on to the end of the year. So Majority Leader has set a Christmas deadline, and he's trying to stick to that. So we have this unusual spectacle of members of Congress having to show up in a snowstorm in the middle of the night to vote on this historic piece of legislation, and they're probably going to miss family activities on Christmas Eve as well.
Yes, they probably will. Well, and they must be tired.
Well, yeah, probably. There's the human factors there, too, but they set this deadline. I think they're very afraid that they're sort of like our students here who have to get term papers done by the end of the semester. And if you say, well, you can have an extension into next semester, then they may never get it done. So without that deadline, they're thinking that it may never happen.
Right. The Chicago Tribune had, well, there's been a lot written about what's going on with all of this. They had an interesting piece yesterday saying that that we are seeing an illustration from this bill of how deeply the healthcare industry has embedded itself on Capitol Hill using former aides of lawmakers and ex-lawmakers themselves. Is there truth in that?
Well, it's We have a system that responds to organized interest groups, and healthcare interests are highly organized. I don't know about placement of former aides and particular people involved, but definitely there's billions of dollars and long-term planning here at stake, and these big industries are going to be very active.
Mm-hmm. They sure have. Somebody was telling us, a guest some weeks ago, that there are 6 members of the insurance and pharmaceutical agencies for every 1 member of Congress. That's a lot, isn't it?
Right. I mean, it's one of the things about our political system is the power of organized interest groups. You know, we have an election system. We had an election last year, and everybody gets 1 vote. And so we're all equal at that point. And then this translates into, our representation in Congress, which is more based on population in the House and much disproportionate in the Senate. And then you have the intensity and the organizational ability and the money that comes from these interest groups, and as they try to affect the governing process.
What do you think is the reason, Professor Kunkel, for no Republican votes on this bill? Obviously, there are a number of progressives who are very concerned about this bill as well. But why not one Republican vote? What troubles them?
Well, we've got a long-term change in the Republican Party and also in the Democratic Party. People are talking a lot about when Social Security was enacted or when Medicare was enacted, that we had more bipartisanship. But we had many more conservative Democrats in those days and many more moderate Republicans. And those people don't exist very much anymore. So the Republican Party is a very conservative party now. There are only one or two really moderates in the Senate. And the Republican base and the Republican activists are very hostile to everything that President Obama wants to do. And, I think the Republicans feel that they were burned even under President Bush, that campaigning as the party against big government, government grew, the deficit grew. And so they're going to dig in their heels on this and really try to defeat it. President Obama has invested huge amounts of political capital in trying to get this through, and so if Republicans could defeat this, then he would be severely weakened in anything else that he wants to do.
So it's purely a political thing. Without a Medicare buy-in, without a public option, you'd be hard-pressed to call it a government takeover of medicine in this country. So it is just political. No matter what it was, there would have been this kind of opposition?
No, I don't say that it's just political. The political maneuvering is the way it manifests itself, but it's rooted in deep policy and philosophical disagreements between the political parties, and what Democrats see as the problem is not what Republicans see as the problem. What are possible solutions? Republicans see Democratic solutions as creating more problems. So people do tend to focus on the combat and the battle and the machinations, but these things are rooted in real policy disagreements and real philosophical disagreements.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin had to say about this. You've also got the president having people who some have called his base in the progressive wing of the party very upset about this bill as well because of lack of Medicare buy-in and public option. Senator Feingold saying over the weekend, "I've been fighting all year for a strong public option to compete with the insurance industry and bring health care spending down. I continued that fight during recent negotiations, and I refused to sign on to a deal to drop the public option from the Senate bill." Then he says, "Unfortunately, the lack of support from the administration made keeping the public option in the bill an uphill struggle. I will be urging members of the House and the Senate who draft the final bill to make sure this essential provision is included." What do you think of that?
Well, the administration, the Obama administration, has let Congress work out the details of the bill, and has opened itself up, and the president's been criticized for not taking a stronger hand. But on the other hand, President Obama probably realizes that he can't make things happen in Congress. Our system doesn't work that way, that it is going to be the leaders of Congress, and you've got to line up the votes to make things happen. So if you want to get something done, which President Obama wants to do, then you have to be willing to compromise. And Senator Feingold saying, well, he's not going to go for anything that doesn't have a public option. We're still in process, and that's part of the process, and that's part of the negotiation that's going to go on. Senate passing a bill is not going to make it law yet. You're still going to have conference committee and get it through the House and get it through the Senate again. So this process is going to continue.
Do you think that Senator Nelson and Senator Lieberman had too much influence on the final bill that the Senate put forward? Did it come down to them what shape it was going to take?
Yeah, it sure does. You know, we have a system that is really not very democratic. The people voted, put the Democrats in power, and the Democrats control the House of Representatives and can get what they want through the House. But the Senate, it does not reflect the population. You know, if you take the two states of, you know, say, Montana and Wyoming, they have equal number of votes to California and New York put together. So the Senate is going to be much more tilted in a conservative direction. Then you have this wacky filibuster tradition, which is not in the Constitution. And to overcome these delaying tactics, you have to have this supermajority of 60 votes. And what that means is that people like Senator Feingold have much less influence on this because they want something to happen, but the people who are willing to let nothing happen, say Lieberman and Nelson, gives them tremendous bargaining power. You know, and this is true whether you like what's coming out of Congress or not.
Right. This bill is very, very lengthy. Are there a lot of parts of this bill that we have no clue about?
Well, for sure. The bill that is going to be passed, presumably by the Senate, is the majority leader's so-called amendment, which is a series of compromises he's worked out. And people like Senator Nelson of Nebraska and Senator Lieberman have had a lot to say over that. In order to get those last few votes, he's had to make a lot of compromises. The legislative process in the United States is a messy process, involves a lot of compromises and horse trading. Years and years ago, the bills were not as complex. There wasn't the media coverage that we have now. You didn't have as many interest groups active, and it was a different situation. So an issue like this is much more complicated. There's much more publicity and openness as far as the process, and there's so many more interest groups involved, and it's a much more partisan process. The fact that no Republicans were willing to support it, even after, you know, weeks and weeks were spent back in the summer to try to win over. You know, you had these negotiations with Republicans. You had Senator Collins of Maine, who was having or Senator Snow of Maine, so much influence of trying to win her over. And then in the end, it's worthless. The Republicans are completely united against it.
Yeah, in the end, she didn't vote for it. At first, she said, well, it was because of the public option. She couldn't vote for that, but she was on board for one of the votes. What happened to her?
Well, she's just sort of been dropped by the wayside. I mean, if you remember, there was a gang of six negotiating in the Senate Finance Committee.
Right.
And then it turned out that there were three Republicans and three Democrats, and two of the Republicans turned out, well, they were just trying to slow down the process and defeat it. And she was the only one that seemed to be involved in any serious negotiation. But she's made, you know, calculation for whatever reasons, which I don't know, that she's not going to support it.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Our guest is Professor Joseph Kunkel, Professor and Chair, Political Science, Law Enforcement Department at Minnesota State University. Obviously, the big news over the weekend is health care and what the Senate voted on last night, the bill that they voted on. You can branch us into other areas of conversation if you'd like, but I have a feeling that many of you will want to talk about this simply because we have covered it so extensively and it's front and center right now. To your calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls now. Let's start with Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I want to talk about framing the health care issue. And framing is discussed by George Lakoff in his great book, The Political Mind, which is a Cognitive Scientist's Guide to Your Brain and Its Politics. And it seems to me that the Republicans and the corporate Democrats, their thinking comes from the wallet, whereas liberals' thinking comes from the heart, for the children. Liberals want to protect children. And how do you protect children? Well, you protect the health of the parents and the grandparents who are working for the children in their interest. And when you protect the family, you protect the future for the children. And the best thing to do in the process, of course, is to expand the government role because this gives a better chance for fairness in terms of pricing and availability of insurance. So it's all for the children, and it's a fair thing to do.
Professor Conkle.
Well, those are nice sentiments, but I don't think, I think it's a pretty harsh assessment of conservatives and Republicans that they don't care about children, too, and that it's just all about the money. I actually don't buy that, and I think that, there's tough knuckled politics on both sides, but I do think that many Republicans are doing what they think is best for families and children. They have a disagreement about how they're going to go about it. Framing is a recent buzzword. Professor Lakoff is getting out there, and it's basically how we're going to propagandize what our position is to make our side look the best and make the other side look the worst.
When you talk, let's go back, though, to these philosophical differences and explore it a wee bit more. When you talk about philosophical differences as it relates to healthcare reform in this country, what are the basic differences?
Well, as the last caller, Jim, said, Democrats see government as being able to play a more positive role in helping people and helping families and creating and sharing prosperity. Republicans do not see government as helpful in this regard and tend to see government as something that is going to redistribute income and impose taxes and create obstacles for private business. Which, according to their ideology, is where all prosperity is going to come from.
Mm-hmm. Which, what you just said, would make it perfectly clear why healthcare reform has been so difficult.
Right. I mean, it's liberals and progressives, generally would like to see a European style single-payer system where you don't really have private companies selling health insurance and that there's going to be efficiencies and fairness that's going to happen with this. But the public opinion in our country is divided enough that you can't achieve something like that. And the Republicans have framed the debate enough have enough support that the threat of a so-called government takeover is going to sound very intimidating rather than very helpful.
Thanks, Jim, for your call. Mary is next. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I'm very disappointed that there's not a public option. As a matter of fact, I would prefer a single payer. But the reason I'm so disappointed is I'm very afraid of this bill. Now young people, all people all over, are going to have to buy insurance. Now, unless the subsidy is, say, so that they don't have to only pay, say, $50 a month or something, my children, personally, will have to choose between their bills, and they will have to choose either insurance, not getting insurance and being fined so they could pay their bills. Plus, I don't see any guarantee that even if they have to, the insurance companies have to accept people with pre-existing conditions. I see no guarantees that they can't charge exorbitant fees to these people. So I am very disappointed, and I'm very afraid that people are not going to be able to pay their bills. and they're going to end up losing homes and going in default from their loans. So I would like some reassurance, and I would also like from this gentleman to tell me some really good things about this bill, because I haven't really heard any good things about this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
Well, I think her concerns, you know, when you have this kind of fear expressed from progressives, and then you add on the fear and the opposition of conservatives, you can see why people are nervous about this and why members of Congress are nervous in taking these votes. The liberals and progressives in Congress are making a judgment that there's enough good things in this bill that it's going to be worth passing. But I can't reassure her on what is in the bill or how it's going to be implemented. Some of these things are not going to kick in for a number of years. I think that that mandate is one of the concerns. And but the insurance reforms that you can't deny coverage to people based on pre-existing conditions and the subsidies and the fact that you're going to have near universal coverage are what progressives are looking at as the big benefits of it. And I think even though many are very dissatisfied with this, they are looking at it as a starting point that you have to get something through now, and that if you get something through, then you can improve it in the future.
And I don't think we know enough at this moment about this mandatory aspect of insurance. That's certainly going to be something that needs to be answered, and it's not totally formulated yet. We got the Senate and House bill to get together on, but I don't think we fully know the answer to that yet.
Right, but you're dealing with the basic problem of trying to get universal coverage without a single-payer system, or any kind of public option, where mm-hmm. the government is going to be selling cheap insurance to people like Mary's children and mine, who are going to have to buy health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So you're forcing them to buy. It's still going to be in the private system.
What's the story with not having a lot of this kick in for a few years? Why is it in the interest of this Congress and this administration to not have something that's fairly immediate?
I'm not sure I quite understand that. I think part of it is to try to, raise some revenue before you have to pay. So some of it is whether there are fees and tax increases and savings, Medicare cuts and so forth that are built in. These things are going to kick in first, and then the things that are going to cost more are going to kick in later. President Obama said that he didn't want health care reform to add to the deficit, and the Democrats in Congress have also said that that's what they want to do. And people are always watching very closely the Congressional Budget Office scoring of how this is going to affect the deficit, what it's going to cost, which is an assessment. You know, who really knows? It's experts giving it their best shot. So I think that's the plan, that you're going to be raising some revenue up front, and then things are going to cost money are going to come in later. Politically, that might be a pretty risky strategy, in that some of the things that will cause pain and discomfort are going to be happening first, and the things that maybe people are going to like won't be happening till later.
Right. We go to Bob from Green Lake next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Hello.
I got to wonder, now, if this thing was such a great deal, why are we hiding behind closed doors in secret? You think that they would be out there telling the whole world what wonderful things they're going to have in store for everybody. You know, 60% or better of the American population wants nothing to do with government-controlled or mandated health care. And I think a lot of these guys right now, seeing what happened back in summer with the town hall meetings, the last time people got educated to what was in this thing. I think a lot of these people are going to have a rude awakening They're going to be in the unemployment lines they helped create after November. This isn't about health care. It's about power. It's about control. It's about moving money from point A to point B, and that's all it is.
And, Bob, what part of the reform troubles you the most?
The mandated telling people they have to buy health care. Now, that's unconstitutional. The government cannot require you to purchase something. You see what goes on in some of these other countries that have this socialized medicine. I mean, I've got relatives that live in Europe. There's certain aspects of their system which works out well for a lot of people. Their system isn't anything even close to what they're talking about here. But there's still instances where there's long waiting periods for things that we take for granted here. MRIs, cancer treatments, all kinds of things of this nature. This is just a big rat's nest. It's going to be awful in years to come if this goes through.
Professor Kunkel.
Well, Bob's got several points he brings up there. As far as the mandate, whether it's constitutional or not, that's an argument that people are making. But government does require people to buy things. You do have to have auto insurance, and at least in our state, and I presume in your state. I was struck by what he said about the secrecy of the negotiation. It's an amazingly open process. Nobody is really pledged to secrecy. We have had television coverage of the committee meetings. We have television coverage of the floor debate. For sure, the real decisions are being made behind closed doors, but that's nothing new. That's the only way you're ever going to get any kind of compromise, and the people who are making the compromises are coming out of these rooms, and then they're making statements about what they've done. For sure, it's a very complex piece of legislation. It's being pasted together. The public doesn't really know what's in it, and probably a lot of the senators don't know everything that's in it because it's a work in process, and that's not a good thing. But politics is messy, and it is imperfect.
What about presidential leadership on this? What do you think if the president early on had said, what's crucial to me, and probably he didn't say because it wasn't crucial to him, to have a strong public option, it's crucial to have a Medicare buy-in, it's crucial to move away from the insurance companies in some way, the government needs to do something in this area. Would he indeed have been able to do this now? I guess my question is why we didn't have a very clear idea of what he wanted.
You know, I think historians are going to be debating this for years, whether he took a firm enough role in the process. But the things that you suggest, public option, Medicare buy-in, so forth, if he had said, it's my way or the highway, it would be the highway. The votes are not there to pass those things. So he wouldn't have been able to get it. I think a more legitimate criticism would be, could he have done something much, much smaller? Could he have gotten Republicans on board to do just a few things? Republicans are very fond of reforming the medical malpractice or tort reform system. Mm-hmm. Could he have done a few things like that without going for this ambitious overhaul and gotten Republicans on board from the beginning? I don't myself think that could have happened either because Republicans have signaled from the very beginning that other than military and some of these foreign policy decisions, they're not going to support him on,
on anything he wants to do.
Thank you, Bob, very much for the call. Alan is next from Madison. Hi, Alan.
Hello.
Hi.
According to both bills right now, there will not be any disqualification for pre-existing conditions. My question is, will insurance companies be able to raise the premiums for pre-existing conditions? And if they can, are there any limits on how much they can raise those premiums?
I don't know that for sure. I thought that they couldn't, but I could be wrong on that. I think that they can charge higher premiums for older people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We'll, as soon as details come out on this, you know that we'll be doing shows on the many parts of this. It's still fairly new, and we don't have a final bill yet with the House. So stay tuned, as they say. Thank you very much, Alan, for your call. What about the amount of money that will go to insurance companies as a result of this? Is this going to be a huge windfall for them, do you think?
It sure looks like it, and that, I think, is the reason that they are willing to accept some of these limitations, like being no longer able to deny people coverage based on pre-existing conditions, because you're going to be taking a group in the population that hasn't been getting insurance, a lot of young people who don't plan on getting sick, and you're going to be forcing them, requiring that they get some level of health insurance. So these are people that will be paying premiums or else being subsidized by the government to pay premiums to put into the private system, but there's not going to be as much to pay out for their health care
mm-hmm.
because they won't be as sick.
We go next to Ann is next from Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Well, I'm a skeptic, and first of all, I don't think there's any difference between the Republicans and Democrats in Congress on either of these bills. I believe the Senate version will prevent the states from setting up better systems, too. The Republicans and Democrats are both getting massive bribes, especially the people in positions of power, from all phases, all parts of the medical industry, to pass something like this, which will force people into the arms of the companies, many of which have been convicted of massive fraud, that will just have absolutely no limits on the amount they can charge the public, and the public will be forced to buy it or to clear themselves paupers. And healthcare reform was supported by the American public because medical treatment is far, far too expensive. And all parts of the medical industry have been gouging the public for the last 30 years. Doctors' practices charge way too much. Hospitals compete to drive each other out of business and gouge patients. Big pharma has increased the cost of pills and other drugs and manipulated the regulators to extend their patents way beyond their usual historical terms. And we've got the only for-profit medical industry in the world. And it's different from car insurance or house insurance because you don't expect to be in a critical car accident. But everybody routinely does see a doctor. And so the Senate bill, and I don't think the House bill does either, but the Senate bill doesn't accomplish the main purpose of health care reform, which is making medical care affordable to everybody and making sure people don't go without it. And just to compare it to, say, NAFTA, when Clinton pushed NAFTA through, which was a big shock to Democrats, the idea was, well, it can be tweaked later on, and the environmental deficiencies and the human rights deficiencies of these trade agreements will be fixed once it's passed. Well, they never did get fixed. They got worse and worse and worse. And finally, Dr. David Shiner, who was President Obama's Chicago physician for a long time, says that what this will do is create, first of all, it's going to be massively more expensive than our present system where people can try to stay healthy and spend almost nothing. You know, certainly not give it unconstitutionally to the insurance industry. But he says that that a third class of patients will be created. They will basically be Medicaid patients. Most doctors will refuse to accept these Medicaid, essentially Medicaid patients, because they'll be getting so little money, and they'll just be left out in the cold just as they are now. So I just think this whole thing is a huge, huge hoax. I mean, we're the only country that ever even conceived of this, and until we get all that money out of Congress, we're going to continue with, you know, the American public has got to wake up and get in the streets. Otherwise, I hate to think how many. And by the time it passed, you know, it's in effect. If it does take effect, the present members of Congress, many of whom are very elderly, will be out of Congress, so they won't be around to be blamed for the outrage they perpetrated.
Professor Conkle.
Well, you know, I think there's a strong group of progressives out there. I'm not sure whether Ann is in this group or not, but people who think that it's better to do nothing if we can't get the ideal system that they want. But the ideal system is not going to happen in this country. Public opinion is divided enough. Republican Party is strong enough. Yes, lobbying interest groups do have influence over both political parties and can shape the outcome. And the rules in Congress, particularly in the Senate, mean that private interests and conservatives have a disproportionate amount of influence. Is there no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans? I don't buy that. But the Democrats in Congress are willing to compromise. And they've gone down the road of compromise, and it gets messier and messier. And you end up with something that progressives and conservatives are both uncomfortable with, opposed to, and people in the middle don't understand.
The other thing, though, we've covered all of this pretty carefully. Let's go back to the polls on this that showed, and I don't believe those have changed that much. It seems to me as though the American public and polls showed that it was way over a majority of the American public wanted some kind of public option in this bill. They also wanted to be able to get their drugs, which makes sense, from Canada or from Europe at a much less expensive price. It seems to me as though both of these, and tell me if I'm wrong here, are indications of the power of the pharmaceutical and insurance industry to A, not have a public option, and to B, to not be able to import drugs less expensively from Canada and Europe. The idea that these drugs may not be safe sounds to me to be a little ludicrous. People aren't dying of bad drugs in Canada and England, are they?
Well, you know, what people say they want in public opinion polls is one thing, but that is not the only input on what comes out of the legislative process. We had an earlier caller talk about framing, and framing also applies to public opinion poll questions and how are you going to ask it. And then how is it going to be discussed in the media by politicians to calm people or to excite their fears? So, you know, your public opinion on polling questions is one thing. The ability of interest groups to organize, interest groups that represent a relatively small number of people, but people that feel very, very intensely about something one way or another, is another factor in understanding our political system. In our political system, it's easier to stop something than it is to make it happen. And so those interests and those senators and representatives who are willing to stop something from happening have much more influence. because it's easier for them than the people that want to make something happen. Mm-hmm. And then that is even more exaggerated in the United States Senate, which doesn't run on the basis of majority rule. It's a minority that's going to have small minorities, and the last few votes are going to have the most influence.
Right. Professor Joseph Kunkel, Professor Chair, Political Science, Law Enforcement Department at Minnesota State University, our guest this hour for All Things Political on this winter solstice. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program, it's a holiday tradition. We talk about best books of 2009, and we'll go a little bit beyond that. We can include a few other recent years. So if you have a book that you thought was just a terrific read, we've had a couple of books recently that have become, one was considered one of the 10 best books of the year by the New York Times, and I would have to agree with that assessment. We will be looking at the best reads, because they're always, it's always great to get a book for the holidays, right? So you'll get some suggestions next hour of the show. And if you'd like to go to our Facebook page anytime, that's great for suggestions for books, recommendations, and we'll read some of those next hour as well. So our Facebook page is, you go to facebook.com, and then you go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and write a little thing about the book that you really loved. And thank you very much. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Heather is next from Madison. Hi, Heather.
Hey, how are you this morning?
All right, Heather. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good.
I was going to call in. I wanted to talk about two things. First of all, I wanted to talk about all the money that's in the system in the United States, but I feel like that was covered pretty well. But I guess the thing that I want to speak to the most is are the scare tactics that are going on about, I mean, you talked about drugs coming in from Europe or Canada, and I just wanted to call as a living witness. My husband is European, and I lived there for 6 years, and I had a child there, and I took medicine, and, you know, it was really just fine. So, you know, the more I see in the United States is that, you know, we keep hearing about how terrible it is in these other countries, and I really feel like that is just meant to scare the American public, because, you know, firsthand experience, I hear about it all the time. You might have to wait a little longer. You might not get as many MRIs or sonograms or whatever it is. But overall, I mean, people are healthy. We've had people in the family treated for cancer, and it's just not true that it's difficult, you know, that it's not as good. Because trust me, here I've had the same kinds of ups and downs with my medical care, and really the fact that it's based on my employment is concerning to our family. So I guess my question is, why can't we get that message out?
Professor Kunkel, why?
Well, I tend to agree with the caller. Americans tend to like America. Americans tend to think that we have it right here. And it starts to sound a little bit unpatriotic to say that things are better in another country. So it's an easy sell to say that more socialized systems or single-payer systems in Europe are bad and that ours is much better. All of these systems have advantages and disadvantages. So the people that do want to create fear of some kind of a European-type system can pick on the particular negatives but not talk about the positives.
Thank you, Heather, very much for your call. We go next to Paul from Madison. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I have a question. If insurance companies are going to be banned from denying coverage and everyone's guaranteed affordable premiums, either subsidized or through the companies precisely, don't these companies stop being insurance companies and simply become health care providers?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about it that way. I don't I think they're still selling. They're going to be selling insurance. They're not actually.
Well, they're going to call it insurance, but if you get sick one day and are entitled to call up an insurance company and start receiving treatment the next day at far lower cost than it's at the cost of a premium rather than the cost of true cost of the health care, aren't they simply finding ways to behave like a public option, being forced, in fact?
Well, no, I think your individual premium is not going to be paying for your health care costs.
But if you...
It's a risk management, and so people who don't need expensive health care are also paying premiums.
Right.
I'm sorry, Paul, we didn't hear the other comment that you had. If you want to go ahead, go ahead.
If the only cost to the individual is his premium, regardless of how sick he is, then the healthcare provider simply, the insurance company simply rearranging the dollars to cover cost, which is exactly what a public option would do.
Hmm.
No, that's what insurance is, to my understanding.
Okay, I think we need to move onward. Let's go to Sam from Birchwood. Hi, Sam.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that the professor said something that is really emphatically and importantly wrong, and that is he said that we are required to have automobile insurance. And in fact, there's no state in this country where that is actually the case, because we all have the option to not have an automobile. We do not have the option to not have selves, so therefore we are required to have health insurance. And that makes it a completely different kind of mandate than thousands and thousands of other legal mandates which have a conditional requirement: if this, then you are required to do X. So it's a totally different thing. And Obama also said this, and this is one of the reasons that I'm really angry at him for saying this publicly, because it's just not a legitimate comparison. And I'm so angry at the idea of an individual mandate. My wife and I have very good coverage for our family, but we are considering dropping it if there's an individual mandate and being fined and taking the fine in protest. Because I think that this mandate to pay for-profit companies our money is absolutely unconstitutional and immoral.
Well, it's interesting. I think caller makes an interesting point about auto insurance. And quite thought about it that way. You are being required to pay to private company. On the other hand, there's many things that government requires you to do, you know, in so-called public interest, like pay income taxes. Well, that's conditional, you know, if you choose to have income. So, you know, what are you going to use as the analogy?
How many people do you think are going to be really... It's just interesting who's upset by this. You got people who you normally wouldn't be political allies, kind of are, for completely different reasons. But it's interesting to hear this play out, isn't it?
Yes. There's a lot of discontent.
Well, thanks, Sam, very much for the call. We have time for maybe one more phone call. Richard from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, thanks, Richard.
My comment / question was this. I know this is being, the health care is being billed as a big reform, but if 80% of people are getting their health care through employers, and that's not going to change... You know, in the end, it doesn't seem like there's going to be much change. I know there may be a mandate here or a law change there, but, I mean, I know I've been from job to job from time to time, and it seems to me it would really reduce costs if I just got my own health insurance through the insurance company or through the government, as opposed to getting it through my employer.
Right. Well, I think that's the basic justification for the reform that's being put through, that yes, most people get it through their jobs, but in the current economy, a lot of people are insecure of their jobs or have lost their jobs, and so
the government is stepping in and is mandating and is trying to arrange circumstances so that more people have a private health insurance, whether they have it through their employer or not.
Thanks so much for the call, Richard. Thank you, Professor Kunkel, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Our guest, Professor Joseph Kunkel, Professor, Chair, Political Science, Law Enforcement Department at Minnesota State University, for all things political this 21st day of December. Just a reminder, go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, write down your favorite read. It could be, we'd like to center on books that came out in the year 2009, but your favorite read of 2009 would be okay, because we all like to read. People listen to public radio like to read, and it's great to get suggestions. You may then want to pass along some of those books to your friends this holiday season. So, books of 2009, the best, coming up next hour of our program, and we welcome you to join us.